Hello there, and welcome to Words on Wednesday with Sylvia Rosenblum. That's me, and this is a podcast channel that features all the conversations from my program Arts Wednesday right here on Eastside Radio, 89.7 on your FM dial, or if you're listening to this, you know very well, it's from our wonderful website, eastsidefm.org. Enjoy. Back in 2011, then Prime Minister Julia Gillard commissioned businessman David Gonski to review funding to schools. Her major concern was that demography didn't equal destiny. So clearly, needs-based funding was the answer. So you would think, but apparently not. All these years, we are still waiting for Gonski. And that's the title of the book by Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner. And Chris joins me in the studio today. Chris, it's actually welcome back to Arts Wednesday, isn't it?
Thanks, Sylvia. Absolutely.
Yeah, we had a conversation somewhere along this line before you wrote the book back in, I think, in 2018. Chris, I want to start by going back to the 19th century because I always think it's good to understand the background. And up until 1880, from the beginnings of the colony here in New South Wales, there was no such thing as state schools, was there?
Only in a very rudimentary form, that's right.
So basically they were church schools, or
yes.
Genteel ladies might offer education genteel young women. But the Public Instruction Act of 1880 changes all of that. Tell us about that.
Yes, it was interesting, and I've been a public educator all my working life. But I have to say that the way we established public education in all the colonies around that time was a flawed model. It was meant to be inclusive, but for some reason, and I'm not attributing blame here, the Catholics either pulled themselves out, refused to belong, or were pushed out. And you can choose a narrative whichever way you like. So what we ended up creating was a wonderful public education system, but it wasn't inclusive. It left some people out in the cold. And the people it left out of getting this free education were the poor Catholics or the Catholics.
Well, because that Act said state schooling should be free, compulsory and secular.
And secular, that's right.
So that's where all the churches jumped up and down and said, what? Take God out of our education? Never.
Yes, the other churches made accommodation with that, but the Catholics didn't.
Didn't.
And again, I say it's the problem was that for the next 80 years, the poorest section of the community could only, if they wanted a Catholic education, they had to pay fees. Whereas you could argue, say, rich atheists didn't. They could go to a public system which was fully funded. Now, that created a very unlevel playing field and a very unsatisfactory situation that lasted until about, as we know, about the early 1960s.
Right. Well, before we get to the 1960s, 1901 we have Federation, and by the Constitution, education is a state responsibility. So it is the job of the states to educate its children.
Yes, and if you look at the administration of education and development of policy in education, you'd have to scratch your head and wonder what happened to the Australian Constitution, because the Commonwealth in the 1970s especially assumed a responsibility for education. But it was a very select opportunity as the decades grew, because it assumed mainly a responsibility for private education.
Well, before we get to that, I mean, the first foray of the Commonwealth into secondary schooling, into what was traditionally and constitutionally a state matter, is that Menzies wanted every school in Australia to have a good science lab and a good library. Very, very commendable. Apparently it was the subject of a court case. Constitutionally, was the Commonwealth able to hand to the states a sum of money with strings attached? And the court found apparently that it was. And thus began what we now see as a behemoth.
Yes. Yeah, so really, in a sense, that what some might see as a constitutional barrier was dispensed with very early in the period that we started rolling out public funding to non-government schools.
And the next sort of thing that really has resonance up until today is the Goulburn Affair. Do you want to tell us about the Goulburn Affair?
The Goulburn Affair was the symbolic beginning of a public funding going to non-government church schools. It happened when the local Catholic schools, or one of the schools in Goulburn, was found to be wanting. Its toilets weren't up to scratch, and they either had to improve or could be closed down. And basically, the Catholic community in Goulburn said, "Look, we can't afford this. We need help." And that was certainly not agreed to initially. So the response was, okay, we'll send all our kids to your schools.
It was the cardinal or whatever the honcho was. He said, right, Friday afternoon, all our schools are closed. Monday morning, you all turn up at your local government school.
Off you go. And it happened. It was very controversial at the time. There were editorials in favour and editorials against. And it divided the town. It was quite... in-your-face stuff. What that did do, though, eventually, of course, state and Commonwealth governments started rolling out support, as we say, the science and library blocks in the early 60s, and then eventually other forms of support started rolling out support, driven by the belief that, my goodness, if we don't fund these existing non-government schools something... they'll all end up in public schools, and it'll cost a fortune.
So that becomes the given wisdom, the accepted wisdom that still adheres today. And as we'll talk later on, it's not really true. But the fact is that opened the floodgates, that now the Commonwealth funds private schools, starting with the Catholic schools. And they were poor schools.
Indeed.
They had poor quality of education. They, you know, used to bring the poor sisters and brothers from Ireland straight off their farms to teach.
Yes.
And it was the poorest of the Catholic people that went there. So it was not a great level of education.
But it was a very unlevel playing field.
But it was important to those families for their children to have a Catholic education.
Yes, of course, absolutely.
So then we come to, all right, it becomes established constitutionally. It's quite okay for the Commonwealth to give money to the states with strings attached, and the Commonwealth now enters this traditional state area of funding education, private education as well as the state schools. How does this money come, Chris? Does the Commonwealth give the money to the schools? Does the Commonwealth give the money to the state? We know that it can tie strings. Does it have to tie strings? Because we know that our state also supports private schools, doesn't it?
Yes. Look, it's gone through many stages over the last few decades. After the Gonski Review, for example, the money was provided direct to schools in the case of the independent sector, for example. It was provided to school authorities in the case of the Catholic and government sectors. So it comes in various ways. And that by itself creates a problem, because when it comes via sectors, sometimes it doesn't always go to where schools are most in need.
But with the wealthy independent schools, they get the funding directly.
Yes.
Are they accountable?
Look, in technical terms, they are, in the sense that they must fully explain what they're doing in exchange for this money. But it's not accountability that's at the core of the problem. It's the obligations that come with the money. And what divides Australian schooling is that the government system alone is obliged to be available to every child from every family in every location under every circumstance. The non-government sector, which is also funded by governments, has no such obligations. So what they got was the funding without serious strings. And that is the beginning, of another unlevel playing field. Yep. When the government schools, which were so obliged to take every student under any circumstance, started accumulating those students who the non-government sector either wouldn't accept or they couldn't afford the fees to attend non-government schools.
Yeah, there was an account in a newspaper recently of St Madeleine's School in Kenthurst, which is accused as allegations that it used school funds to buy property, which would be regarded as for profit, and apparently part of the conditions of getting funding is that it can't be for profit. But their accountability, it's just interesting. Do you have to say this is what we spent the money on? You know, if you're a wealthy private school and you want to sort of actually have professional theatre equipment in your very modern theatre, Do you have to say that's what you spent the money on?
Look, this issue of profit or non-profit, I think, is very elusive. I mean, all schools, for example, government, non-government, carry from one year to another some retained earnings for contingencies that are going to come up in the future. Obviously, the retained earnings in very high fees are substantial amounts of money. Now, as far as that particular Catholic school is concerned, we've yet to find out.
Right.
But obviously, if it is as alleged, it's a very serious situation. I suspect it's not a common situation. In fairness, I'd have to say
right.
we would have known if... but I think the boundaries are a little bit blurred.
Right.
And certainly that's one area where there should be better monitoring.
But, yeah, there should. So, we've established that independent schools get money by the Commonwealth directly to the school. When it comes to state schools, it goes to the New South Wales government. When it comes to the Catholic sector, it goes to the Catholic Education Office.
Yes, that's right.
For distribution. And do they, is the Catholic Education Office obliged to say where it's spent all its money?
Apparently it is. The problem, however, they keep running into, and there's been a couple of audits and other inquiries that have discovered, including the ABC released information about this two or three years ago, that discovered that the actual distribution is not really along the lines that Gonski, well, not at all along the lines that Gonski intended. And one of the reasons for that, I suspect, is that the Catholic system wants to compete with the independent system
right.
at that high end, so is not backward in coming forward to direct funds to what are perhaps already well-endowed Catholic schools.
Yeah, but with the point you make in the book, of course, is that there has been a change from the days of the 60s where Catholic education is no longer the poor relative. And the poorer Catholic families are no longer going to the Catholic schools, and they've moved up into the area of the middle class. So
yes.
Catholic schools themselves have changed, haven't they?
They certainly have. If you rank the three sectors in terms of the socio-educational advantage, or let's loosely call it SES, according to the SES of their enrolments. The independent schools are at the top with, on the MySchool website, what we call ICSEA, this index of socio-educational advantage, a value of 1070. The Catholic schools come next with an average value of around about 1035. And government schooling comes with an average value, ICSEA value, of about 985. So that hierarchy of schools is embedded in our education and has been now for decades.
Yeah. I think there's plenty more to talk about, but let's take a break and listen to a little bit of music, and then we'll come back and keep talking. If you've just joined us, I'm Sylvia Rosenblum. This is Arts Wednesday here on Eastside Radio, 89.7 on your FM dial, or eastsidefm.org if you're listening to us online. My most special guest in the studio is Chris Bonner. He is one half of the two authors that have recently published, it's gone out of my head.
Waiting for Gonski.
Waiting for Gonski.
How Australia Failed at Schools.
How could I forget that? So Chris is in the studio with me. Tom Greenwell, who's his co-author, unfortunately is not. Let's listen to some music. Chris, I want to turn my attention now to the formula for funding. I mean, we all know it's not fair because it's not needs-based, but what is it? Can I just give you a quote? Government funding for private schools in Australia has increased at nearly five times the rate of public school funding over the last 10 years. This is February 2022, according to a new analysis, with predictions of a $74 billion shortfall in money for public schools this decade, despite the shift to a needs-based system. For me, that's actually a shocking statistic.
It is. We talk about the shift of the needs-based system. As Gonski intended, that shift could have taken place. A base grant was available for every school, but there was a funding loading attached to that funding depending on the needs of the students. And there were a series of measures, SES, parents' occupations, location, Indigenous status or not, whatever. And these loadings were on top. The problem was, in the immediate aftermath of 2012, when the report was handed down, the non-government school pressure groups started effectively lobbying It was always going to be the case that no school was to lose a dollar.
See, this is what I want to talk about, because if you're going to have true needs-based funding,
yes,
and given the situation that we'd got into, then to be totally fair, some of the schools would have to lose their funding while other schools had their funding bumped up. And that was the sticking point, because the wealthy, very wealthy independent schools said, what? Take away money from me? You know, with their millions of dollars income a year and their theatres and their sporting fields and their Olympic pools and everything else. And that was the sticking point. And that was what you call God and Mammon, the unholy alliance of God and Mammon.
Yes, yes, that term comes from Gough Whitlam, I must confess. And basically what it meant was that the high fee Protestant schools, basically when the Catholic schools started getting funding back in the 1960s and 70s, the high fee independent schools put their hands out as well. But they were shielded.
So we take children off your hands too. Yeah, yeah. We want money too.
But they were in a sense shielded forever after in their pressure for public funding of non-government schools behind the Catholic system, because the Catholic system was projected, and they were a poorly funded system in overall terms for quite a while, the Catholic system. But they, the wealthy independent schools came in on the coattails. And that has been a feature of the lobbying for non-government schools ever since.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that the independent schools are not the wealthy schools, and we're not talking about poor schools here, we're talking about very wealthy schools, are not prepared to give up their funding under any circumstances. Yeah. And we have had that, and so powerful is that lobby of these wealthy schools that every government, be it on the left or be it on the right, has said no school will lose funding, and then they add in real terms. So even should the value go down, then they will go up within inflation or the CPI or whatever it is. Such is the power of this lobby that no government is prepared to say, hang on, you know, and we did have Shorten in the 2016 elections saying that told all that, you know, that they're trying to take your money away from you, the Catholics.
Yes, yes.
And told all the Catholics, all Catholics were ordered to vote for Labor.
Yes.
It didn't help him.
Yes.
But that's what he ordered. So, but the interesting thing is the Catholic school sector joined forces with this wealthy independent school. Even there was no chance of them losing their funding. They seemed to find, what was their common alliance?
Well, the common alliance was built around this, partly built around the No School Loses a Dollar edict. And of course, that also came from some bitter experiences in the 1970s, 80s, and in the 2004 federal election, when Labor was accused of having a hit list of schools that would lose funding. So when Gillard became Minister for Education and Prime Minister, she was very keen to press that no school would lose a dollar, which, as you suggest, is a nonsense proposition. If you're looking at equity funding, and if the money available is limited, some schools would have to lose a dollar.
And that was our problem, and the ones that were going to lose money were the ones with all the power. Now, Chris, I want to ask you something that might sound a little bit controversial and it might sound a little bit silly, but what I want to know was, apart from unnecessary things like professional theatre equipment and Olympic-sized swimming pools and fully equipped grandstands, which are not necessary for education, I'm interested in what money actually does inside a school. And in the papers recently, in the same edition of the paper, were two different stories of two different schools. And I wonder if I could relate those and get your opinion. The first story concerned Walgett High, which is a very disadvantaged school. In the last 2 years, there have been more than 50 cases of violence, including the use of weapons and assaults on teachers. It has had 31 principals in 24 years. The turnover of teachers is very high, and there are always many vacancies. They can't fill them. The Department of Education, needing to do something about this awful situation, has thrown money at Walgett High. $9 million from the makeover of buildings in 2020. It receives the highest per capita funding of any school in the state, with more than $44,500 for each child. and we haven't seen a noticeable improvement.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to say is, what does money do here?
Money is limited. Money is limited in what it can do, and I'm always concerned about election auctions to see who's going to provide the most money. Because what matters in schools is not only the funding they receive. The most powerful resource that comes into a school from outside are kids that walk in every day. Because aspirant and achieving students are a huge bonus for a school. Now, you mentioned Walgett. Look, every day in that town, some people bundle into cars and go to school in Lightning Ridge. But what kids go to school in Lightning Ridge? Usually or to another town, or in Sydney to another suburb, or to another sector or whatever. Usually those that are better off, that have the funding available to either get there, that can press the buttons to get enrolments in the schools that they prefer. So the big drift in enrolments has been from low SES schools to high SES schools, leaving schools like Walgett. And Walgett's an extreme example, but it's just symbolic of what's happening all over Australia.
All right, so we're getting towards a solution here that really has got nothing to do with money. I guess at a baseline, you know, there's got to be, operable toilets and
toilet paper.
And soap and things like that.
Yes.
But once those basics are accounted for, Walgett High apparently has not benefited from money. In the same edition of the Daily Newspaper, on another page, there was a story of another school. And this is Shaw, which about as far removed from Walgett High as you could possibly get. A school on the North Shore, Anglican school. And in the last 2 years, over 90 staff have left. Staff morale is reported to be incredibly low. Their teachers earn more than 16% above the award at other private schools, according to this article. They have an income of $65 million per year. They are reputed to charge $36 a year for their fees. There's a new headmaster come in, and apparently his new broom sweeps clean policy is what's alienated a lot of teachers, left many of them to absolutely go. What did we hear? It was 90 staff have left in 2 years, leading to low morale, and the headmaster has actually apologised to all of the staff. That was the gist of the article. Mm-hmm. Now, you're an ex-headmaster. My view is that if there's low morale in the teaching staff, then no good education's going on at that campus.
That's right.
So here we've got another where there's more money than you can poke a stick at.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's it doing?
Well, basically, I suspect the problem at that school has been also, which has taken place in a lot of high-end independent schools, is that somebody's come in and wanted to shift the culture of the school. These are described as elite schools. They enrol a certain profile of kid. They cater for certain families. They are allowed to do effectively what they like. So if the culture works or seems to work, anyone who challenges will be certainly find it very, very difficult. Look, I went as principal to a couple of schools. Yeah, one of the schools I went to, I had to go in and make substantial changes because it was losing enrolments. So that always gets hackles up. Or it worked, and the school went from strength to strength. But the point is, it's always a challenge. I mean, it was interesting in that story about that school, the salaries for the teachers. There's no regulation, no framework. So it's emblematic of the unlevel playing field. You've got the school down the road, which must stick to award wages or must, you know, there's a limit to what it can pay teachers, even if it wanted to pay more. Whereas the high fee schools tend to determine their own provision. And of course, they also, by the level of the fees that they charge, they decide who walks in through the front gate each day.
Yeah. So I think with my two examples of these two very, very different schools, we're seeing that money per se, even though that's what the argument is about in needs-based funding, money per se is not really the answer if what we're after is educational outcomes. Good educational outcomes for everybody. Chris, that's a topic I want to pick up. But let's stop and take a break, listen to a bit of music, and come back and talk about that. If you've just joined us, I'm Sylvia Rosenblum. Arts Wednesday here on Eastside Radio, 89.7 on your FM dial, or eastsidefm.org if you're listening to us online. My most special guest in the studio is Chris Bonner, and I'm not going to forget the name of his book this time. It's Waiting for Gonski. Chris, one of the things that you've alluded to, and I know it's very close to your heart, and that's this level playing field. What is it?
It's the advantage that accrues to some schools and disadvantage accruing to others by the way the whole system's structured. For example, we mentioned the beginning of public education, how poor Catholics, if they want to go to Catholic schools, they still had to find the money, but they ended up going to public schools. So there was this level of discrimination that occurred. And of course, from the 1960s onwards, the playing field tipped upside down, where the non-government schools and sectors were substantially funded from both private and public sources. And the public sector was not only funded in fairly ordinary ways, but its enrolments skewed dramatically between the mid-1970s and the beginning of this millennium.
Right. So what we've seen, and you referred to that when we were talking about Walgett High in the drift to Lightning Ridge, but we've seen generally a drift. We are a wealthy society. Catholic education is not the poor standard education that it was in the bad old days. And it's heading more up to be closer to the wealthy independent schools. And so we've got a drift increasingly to our independent schools, leaving all the problems back in the state schools. Are they problems?
Yes, look, before we get to the problems, the drift itself is actually more complex. It certainly was from government to non-government schools in the 80s, 90s and early 2000s. But there's a substantial drift also from low SES government schools to high SES government schools. And that is exacerbated in the public system, for example, by the establishment of selective high schools, which take that demographic anyway, and leave nearby and even further afield public schools with a higher proportion of strugglers. Now, that is a critical problem that accumulated at the end of the last century and started emerging in PISA data about Australia early this century. And Gonski was aware of that and explained it in great detail, but didn't do enough about it. Right. And that's one of our problems with the Gonski Review.
Well, so what in simple terms, we're saying that if you've got a more mixed student body, we're going to have better educational outcomes. You
Absolutely.
Can't have the stragglers all together with nobody else to inspire them. And it made me think one of the things you report in the book is a conversation between two schoolboy friends, David Gonski and Malcolm Turnbull, in the playgrounds of Sydney Grammar, with David Gonski saying to Malcolm Turnbull, "When you become Prime Minister, can I please be your treasurer?" If you've got that sort of friend from school and that sort of influence that carries on into your adult life, it's very hard to compare with a straggling school like Walgett High, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, some schools have a selected peer, have a selected enrolment, and place discriminators in place to leave others out. And, of course, it's not necessarily an active discrimination. Fees alone are a passive discriminator. They don't have to go out and say, look, I'll have you, 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 and you others go away. That's how the system works. That's how the system is structured. But the effects on overall student achievement in Australia because of that peer effect in the most disadvantaged schools is something, unless we overcome that, we're not going to get anywhere.
Well, I remember back in the 70s when I was doing a master's degree in education, the educator, an educational thinker that I was reading was an American called Christopher Jenks. And one of the studies that he did was having a look in adult life, what did actually school do? And what he concluded was that the best thing school can do can give you peers. And that had the biggest effect. So that basically what he's saying, what goes into a school is what comes out of a school.
That's right.
And that's exactly what Gillard didn't want. Let's not make demography equal destiny. But in point of fact, it was happening. And it still happens.
And worse than that, it's actually increasingly happening, because the data on the My School website, which tells a lot about who goes into schools, students and money and whatever, and what comes out, is clearly showing that we're increasing our concentration of strugglers in low SES schools and concentrations of the most advantaged in the higher fee and selective government schools. So we are making the problem worse. But we try to overcome the problem by introducing all sorts of reforms in what goes on inside schools. Now, here's the sad story. Teachers are the biggest effect inside schools. We know that. But schools and teachers lag behind peers and parents in terms of what really, in overall terms, influences levels of student achievement. And while we continue to let peers and parents have this sort of stranglehold on student achievement, we're going to keep falling behind, and we're clearly falling behind other countries.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What do we want? We want to have good educational outcomes for our children, but if we're to look at the so-called objective measures of NAPLAN and OECD numbers, we're falling behind. We're not getting great educational outcomes. They're getting worse every year.
Yes, they are. And not only that, but I've looked at, done some research looking at the distribution of HSC, VCE and high scores in other states, and they are increasingly being concentrated in high SES schools. I mean, there was a time I was a teacher at Mount Druitt in the 1970s. Those schools had a small but significant proportion of high achieving kids. But now they've gone.
Right. And, yeah, I remember when I was a school teacher, I taught at a boarding school, so a lot of country girls. And I remember at the end of it, one cow cocky's kid came up and said to me, "Miss, I'm a dum-dum. I know I'm a dum-dum, but you never treated me like a dum-dum," because it was one class per year. And so I had to keep up with the other kids. And I did. I mean, I'm still a dum-dum and I didn't do as well, but thank you for that. And it really gave me food for thought.
Yes, yes. Look, it's interesting, Sylvia, because intuitively, and we can't blame parents for the choices they make, but intuitively they know that it's worth getting their kids into higher SES schools. Sure, they explain it in terms of competition and so on, but there's a whole complex array of things that bear that out.
And why shouldn't they? Because we know it works.
Yes, because you're talking. Because the story you're narrating is about teacher expectations, isn't it? I expect you to do well. I expect you to try your hardest. Now, with the best will in the world, it's really hard to maintain those high expectations, diverse curriculum, extra opportunities in a school where the strugglers are basically in a very substantial majority. You know, we talk about parachuting the best teachers into the struggling schools, and we do that. But, you know, the most aspirant, engaged and achieving kids have already gone out the back door.
It
makes that teacher's job much harder.
I want to get up to the last chapter of your book where you propose solutions, and some of them are pretty dramatic. The first thing, and we referred to this back when we talked about the history of Commonwealth funding of our schools with the Goulburn story, and the rationale there was, look, we better give them money because otherwise all the kids will come to our school, so it's more efficient for the taxpayer to pay these private schools. That's the received wisdom. It operated then, it operates now. But quite surprisingly, you've done the homework and the mathematics, and it doesn't add up. It's not saving the taxpayer money.
If the Catholic community and the bishops tried today to send their kids, all their kids, high school, primary schools, to the Goulburn public schools, the taxpayer overall would save $2 million a year in recurrent funding.
So there you go. So there's a received wisdom that nobody has challenged, and it's a furphy.
It is.
What you're proposing is that all fees be abandoned, that government pays for all schools. So, but there's a couple of strings attached to you.
Yes.
Tell us how you envisage that.
Basically, we're saying that, we're saying, and it would only cost a small proportion of what we spend now on recurrent funding of schools. We're saying that all schools should be not charge fees. And it's a fascinating proposal because it blows open the prospects and the chances for school choice. Because often, you know, people like us are accused of being against choice. Not at all. We would dramatically increase choice. But of course, in return for being receiving public funding to the same amounts as equivalent public schools, the schools must be, they are obliged to serve their community, and especially a local community. They are, if they charge fees, they would lose their public funding. And there's a whole raft of things that would obviously be negotiated in terms of the way they operate.
But
the obligations would be the same.
So they can accept all children. They can't say no to some. They and as you say, if they charge fees, well, that's it, fine. Go your own way. But there's no teachers, as we just talked about at Shaw, that are getting 16% above the average, or reported to be getting 16% above other teachers at private schools. All that's out the window. All teachers get paid the same.
Well, if they wanted to be remained public, private schools not get any funding, in a sense, at one level, they can do what they like.
And the interesting thing, Chris, is that this is not, I mean, as outlandish as it sounds to our system, it's not a brand new system. You talk about it happening in Canada, the Netherlands and New Zealand, and some of them going back into their histories as well.
Yes, look, and if you look at Canada, you go right back to 1867. If you look at Britain, for example, it was after the Second World War, New Zealand in the mid-70s. In those places at various stages, governments agreed to fund the church schools, the alternative private system. New Zealand's an interesting one because it was relatively recently the New Zealand Catholic schools went cap in hand to government, just as they did in Australia. But the government said, we will fund you, but you must become part of the state's provision of education. Sure, you can remain Catholic schools, and the Canadian Catholic schools the same. Their special character, their special purpose is still retained. But there's no social class division. There's no hierarchy, socio-educational hierarchy of schools. So fully funded public education, whether it be in state schools or Catholic schools, in countries like New Zealand and Canada and so on, is obviously the majority form. And private schools, fully private schools, in most OECD countries, are around anything between about 4 and 8%.
Right.
They're the ones that opt out.
Right, so that we would only have 4 to 8% opting out. I can think of some schools right away that would opt out. The interesting thing is you're not losing the character of your school. If you're a school with a specific mission, be it Montessori or Catholic or whatever
Absolutely.
It might be, you still keep that
sure.
ethos.
Sure.
But you're obliged to do other things. So you can't do things like say, well, you can't come to my school if you come from two suburbs away, and you can't say, as happened to somebody in our family, you sign in year 7 a document that says that in year 10, if you're in the bottom 10% of this year, you must go. You can't do any of that.
No.
And what you end up is with a mixed student body, which is going to benefit everybody.
You would end up with a far more mixed student body. That's right. And you'd gain from that peer influence instead of one sector especially losing out.
Chris, it's very fair, but how likely do you think it is to happen?
You know, at one level, Sylvia, it's not at all likely. Because, see, if you put yourself in a position of Catholic school authorities and independent schools, they have their cake and they eat it too. They have school fees, which incidentally I would argue are icing on the cake, as well as substantial government funding. Why would they accept another 3 or 4 or 5% government funding to lose all that discretion over all the decisions they make? Certainly most of the decisions.
But the money.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. But of course, it places them in an invidious situation in a way. Is a Catholic school, are the bishops going to say no? Because the response is obviously, so you don't want poor Catholics in your school, or you don't want poor Anglicans in your school. Is that what you're saying, Bishop? Now, really, it's a challenge. So yeah, we pitch that as a challenge because they need to come to grips with what our current system, our current hierarchy of schools is serving up, and the big price that Australia is paying because
well, we're not serving our children well educationally, and there is no better investment, more important investment, or greater investment that any nation can make than in its children.
Exactly right.
Chris Bonner, keep fighting, mate.
Thanks very much, Sylvia.
That's been my most special guest, Chris Bonner.
You've just been listening to a podcast from Words on Wednesday with Sylvia Rosenblum.
If you'd like to subscribe to this series, just stay on the page where you are and you'll see at the top line a subscribe to Words on Wednesday. Click on that and you're in business. Thanks for listening.